Today's episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter the offer code PEL at checkout to get 10% off.
This episode is also brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/PEL and enter promo code PEL. This is The Partially Examined Life.
Welcome to part two of episode 123 on economics. We've spent a lot of time at least saying what F.A. Hayek had to say about how great the market is. I'm sure we'll complain some more about that and why he's completely full of shit. And, but for the most part, we want to focus on Amartya Sen in terms of page count, who's quite a bit longer than the Hayek, which we've introduced this. Seth, be our guest. Give us a little push to get started back on this second reading.
Sure. The most interesting part of the argument here is Amartya Sen says, sometimes economics makes these normative declarations that you should organize yourself, your economy in such and such a way. That's called welfare economics. And Amartya Sen's got some problems with the way that welfare economics was done in the mid-1980s. So Amartya Sen does this thing where he divides utilitarianism into three parts. The first part is consequentialism. So an action or a policy should be judged based on its consequences. The second is welfarism. Welfarism is the idea that the goodness of a society or the goodness of an individual is contained in their utility, that you can just kind of, maybe it's not a number, but you can rank an individual's goodness from best to worst, and then you somehow do some combination of all the individuals to talk about society. Third part of utilitarianism is some ranking, which is you decide what's the utilitarian best outcome by adding up everybody's individual utilities. Consequentialism, Sen has no problem with, but the other two, he casts a critical eye at.
The overall idea, right, is he's criticizing this engineering approach to economics in which you ignore the fact that people often make their decisions not simply out of self-interest or to maximize their own particular utility, but that they are often doing things, for instance, for ethical reasons or normative reasons, however we want to put that, and for a variety of other reasons. I mean, he's going to break these down into little categories. So he's criticizing this utilitarian assumption. So for instance, we're not necessarily self-interested. We don't always behave rationally. And even if we did always behave rationally, that's not the same thing as behaving in a purely self-interested manner. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So I guess the first thing I would say is Sen talks about consistent behavior.
That's one version of rationality, consistency, right?
So. Precisely. Let me take an even farther step back. So economics wants to talk about how do individuals act and how do societies come about as interactions of individuals. In order to get into that, in order to make quantitative predictions and do all the stuff that economics wants to do, you have to make some sort of assumptions about how people behave. The most common assumption is you assume some sort of what used to be called rational behavior. People shy away today from using the term rational. You know, they say they obey according to such and such axioms. But the baseline version of rationality is the idea that people choose the best option from their set of options and that their set of options is complete. So given any two choices, they are able to choose one of the two choices or say that they're indifferent between the two and they don't care. And they have to have transitivity over their choices. So that means that if they prefer Cheerios to Apple Jacks to hamburgers, they can't prefer hamburgers to Cheerios because that would be really weird, right? It's, you really prefer Apple Jacks to Cheerios if then you prefer Cheerios to hamburgers, hamburgers to Apple Jacks, right? It's how would you even go about making a choice if you had intransitive preferences like that?
All of which is familiar to people who study philosophy and logic. Those principles of consistency and completeness and those sorts of things. The assumption is that is the way human beings understand and manage their choices.
Most economists aren't welfare economists, right? That's one of the things that Sen has a problem with. Most of us just want to be positive engineering economics. And if that's all you care about, well, then You don't even need for those preferences to have anything to do with what's good for a person or what a person wants. They just need to act in such a way that it is rationalizable as though they had this complete and transitive list of preferences. And then once you see them make some choices, you can predict how they'll make choices in the future.
Very briefly, you talked about engineering.
Mm-hmm. So today I would call that positive economics. So it's just descriptive.
Yeah, that's how Sen starts off this essay. He distinguishes between the two roots of economics, what he calls the ethical and the logistical. And he says it was born in both, but over time, the ethical part has been neglected in favor of the logistical to the detriment of the field. So his project is to say economics could be a lot better if it would pay attention to these things that we've talked about in part one and that he's going to talk about.
Just to make that clear, he cites this ancient Kautilya's Arthasastra from the 4th century BC. This is the first economics textbook, The Science of Wealth, which he says was the first example that he can find of this engineering approach, which is really just, it sounded like Machiavelli to me. There's an interesting amorality going on there. There's a science of governing was part of this work, and the science of wealth was part of this work, to just instruct a king on how to generate more wealth.
It's 100% instrumental. Like, we don't care why you're raising taxes. Just this is how to raise more taxes.
Yep. Hmm. Whereas Aristotle takes it, you know, I guess I didn't realize that he mentioned things that sounded like economics in his politics, but that he sees it as part of the human good. Of course, wealth is only of instrumental value, but still the fact that something is of instrumental value means you have to consider it as well, not just the things that are good in themselves.
Yeah, Aristotle's telling you to do all this different stuff. These are all the different virtues. And kind of mixed up in that are some politics, are some economics, are some ethics. And they all kind of come together into how you should act.
Yeah, those are the ancient roots. And then he points back to the Scottish Enlightenment figures, specifically to Adam Smith, and makes the point that Adam Smith was a professor of moral philosophy, and he wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiments before he wrote The Wealth of Nations. And he's going to go further into how Smith was misinterpreted or has been misinterpreted or selectively interpreted. That's the pedigree. I mean, he's citing a pedigree approach or an authority approach to one reason why economics has lost its connection to its past. But he has a whole bunch of other arguments.
Better ones.
Much better ones, yeah. So one of the first key points that he brings up, and the mechanism by which he thinks that economics has forgotten this ethical side, is by restricting this notion of rationality that Seth mentioned earlier. And he says modern economics has this idea that actual behavior is rational. And he says there's a couple problems with that. One is, even if it's true that actual behavior is rational, that doesn't mean that all behavior is rational. There's room for other types of behaviors that may influence people's thinking. And then he says, claiming that actual behavior is a very different thing than talking about what the content of rational behavior is itself. So you can take issue with the characterization of human behavior as rational, or you can take issue with the definition or the way in which he says economics characterizes the rational.
Before we add on more stuff to what rationality is, how do you guys feel about just that really basic definition of rationality, which is that your behavior is interpretable as though you had complete and transitive preferences? Do you already see a problem there? And I think there are already problems there. But is that like, how do you guys feel about that?
Yeah, I definitely see a problem there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we should also get into the Sen section where he talks about these two versions of rationality, consistency versus maximization of self-interest. But
sure, right, yeah.
Yeah. What Sen says there is basically that those two conditions, Wes, are what constitute this rational notion of being a rational self-interested agent is the consistency of choice, which is that transitivity and what have you, and transparency, and then the maximization of self-interest. So those two things together are how rationality gets cashed out in this modern economic view. And I wanted to ask, and mm-hmm. I think it's already kind of been answered in some respect, whether this was a straw man, because kind of like Mark, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, there can't be that many PhDs around the world that think that that's the case. Because it's just patently false that people's choices are transparent to them, and also that transitivity obtains. I mean, I've got that not thinking fast and slow. What's the Tversky, Amos Tversky, the psychologist? It's one of those popular, famous books that's actually a little more academic. But anyway, the idea that you can influence people's choices simply by putting different other choices next to them. So you can have somebody choosing between A and B, and you can make them choose A by putting A and B next to C, and you can make them choose B by putting A and B next to D. It's a framing effect. It just patently violates or points out that the transitive thing is just false. And so, yeah, I don't buy that.
Yeah. So to address whether this is a straw man, what I think economics would say is that any model of the world is incorrect. It's a model. It's an oversimplification. You face a trade-off then between the more aggressive assumptions you're willing to make and the more detailed predictions you're going to be able to get out and testable predictions versus making less assumptions and being more realistic, but being able to predict less. And so economists are going to make lots of different assumptions about different kinds of behavior for different kinds of models and different kinds of contexts. So I have a friend who's a decision theorist. Decision theory is exactly trying to deal with, for example, these behavioral economic problems of, oh, look, I'm a behavioral economist. I can make somebody do something irrational or something that looks irrational. And then decision theorists kind of catch up and say, okay, I've now reframed the problem so it's rational, but in this other way. So you can make these different assumptions, and maybe you don't want to use the word rational anymore, but you can make these different assumptions that captures that behavior. And then maybe an applied economist can then take that different set of assumptions and maybe make a better model. But the short answer is there's always trade-offs between stronger assumptions and more realistic models that predict less. And you're going to use different axioms about human behavior in different contexts.
Sen talks about consistency first, as if some theorists think that rationality is identical with consistency, even apart from the question of self-interest. It's still a matter of maximization, but it's according to some binary relation where you're not identifying exactly what they're maximizing. You could call it utility, the utility function.
Just call it preference. Yeah, they just do their preference. Yeah.
And that's got to be fully transitive and representative by a numerical function and so on and so forth. And then we get to the identification of one element of that binary relation with self-interest. So that's a second step. I just wanted to point that out.
Precisely. So then you can be more aggressive. We started off and we just said we want to describe human behavior. Obviously, we want to make predictions about how people will act in the future based on how they acted in the past. One way to do that is to say when people act, they tell you something about their preferences. And it doesn't have to do anything necessarily with they're good or whatever. It's just, okay, they acted that way in the past. Let's see how they act in the future. And you make different axioms about what sort of actions in the future are entailed by actions in the past. Now, once you want to take a step further and you want to do normative or welfare economics, you need some sort of access into what's good for people. And because we come from this utilitarian Scottish Enlightenment tradition, the natural move is to say people choose what's good for them.
Among the available options.
Amongst their options. They maximize over their budget set.
So Sen's, he objects to the identification of rationality with consistency just because people could consistently do crazy things.
Sure.
And then the identification with self-interest, the idea is that you might have what he calls, quote unquote, ethics-related motivations or goals that are not self-interested.
Yeah. So there's lots of different ways you might not be self-interested.
Yeah.
You might be crazy. You just have no control over your actions. You might choose bad things for yourself. You might get addicted to drugs.
So I could consistently be pursuing that goal.
Exactly. Yeah.
You might be a human being whose telos is not at all obvious, as is the case with all of us.
Yeah, but you have better access to your telos than I do.
Hegel would say exactly the opposite, actually, that we have a much more objective take on each other than we do on ourselves.
Mark, I know you're good. Stop playing music. It's bad for you.
Well, maybe you might point out that actually I'm an untalented hack and I really need to hear that. So I stop doing this destructive thing.
You know that because the prices for your music are low.
Brutal.
All right. Brutal. Yeah.
Spoken like an economist.
Yeah, this is the harsh words.
The dismal science.
We've done a good job of figuring out what philosophy is worth on the open market.
And squeezing blood out of stone.
Yeah.
So Sen points out these problems with traditional economic theory and these oversimplifying assumptions it makes. And it seems to anticipate the end of the essay to set up a research problem for himself to say, well, we have to get a more sophisticated take that takes these things into account. Mm-hmm. If you want to explain why economic success happened in Japan, one of the things you want to look at is their culture and their interdependence, things in their ethics. So he sets up, aren't there a lot of interesting relations of ways that you could give these sociological explanations for why something succeeded or didn't succeed? But the hope is still that you could still be an economist doing this, not merely just a social observer making keen observations, but you could still hammer this into some sort of theory. And this is where it seemed to fall apart for me, is he very correctly points out all these complexities, for instance, with the notion of human happiness, which we had a really nice episode a long time ago with Owen Flanagan, where we talked about all the different conceptions of happiness and what could go into this, but yet still thinks that you could still make economics not just predicting local things. I mean, I'll buy that, of course, the microeconomics. I want to determine if we raise interest rates now, what'll happen, or if I raise the price of this particular good that I have. I don't think we just have to take a guess into nothing. And the choice is certainly not just between dismissing economics as voodoo altogether, that we're never going to make predictions about anything, versus a completely positivistic view of it. But still, he ends up very optimistic about his research project in a way that I know much less about it. You know, feeling like I'm overhearing some dialogues between people that I'm basically unfamiliar with.
What don't you share? You don't
I do not share his optimism
about the idea that you can, for an economic theory,
you can solve these problems that he's pointing out. Yes.
That you can solve which problems? The theoretical problem of figuring out how people actually behave, or the larger welfare goal of producing an optimal? Because those are two different things.
Yeah, there's the micro and the macro.
I guess it was a little unclear to me which he's trying to address.
He's kind of doing both at the same time. I agree. It's kind of mixed up, but
yeah, he does. I thought he mixed it up as well. Mm-hmm.
I mean, he makes some very good points about, you know, I know he's concerned with making poverty less acute, making inegalitarianism less acute. And I know somewhere in here, I recall him saying something like, we don't have to have a model of the perfect society in order to, you know, actually, this might not have been something that came out of him. This was something that came out of the Elucidations interview with him. So I'll point people, I'm breaking the rule.
Oh, shit.
It may or may not have been reflected in this book also, his very hands-on approach towards economics. And I think part of what he's trying to do is to get rid of some of these positivistic, it seems like somebody like Hayek is going to say, just theoretically, you don't want to mess with the market. If you mess with the market, horrible things are going to happen. You're going to screw everything up. So we have to let whatever kind of awful inequalities, therefore, this is the way at least it plays out in present political discourse, persist. And Sen definitely doesn't buy that and thinks that we can make a lot of headway in heading those things off without solving.
Well, Hayek, like Smith, wasn't opposed to government intervention and poverty and things like that.
He was to the right of Keynes, but a lot of people are to the right of Keynes.
He said things even in The Road to Serfdom, the background research I did for this, where he said, it's perfectly fine to have a safety net and all of those, then we ought to and all that stuff.
So, okay. Yeah. So I was reading too much into his glorification of the price system.
I don't want to get into some already, but you know, you have to, what would be the alternative to a price system? I guess I would say two things to what you said. The first interesting thing is that, so you said you were maybe more optimistic about economics's ability to talk about relationships between different macroeconomic variables, like a relationship between the interest rate and the unemployment rate, let's say. So that's something you would be more optimistic about?
I don't have any opinion on that. I was being less optimistic than Sen about the ability to take all these complicated variables into account, particularly the complexities that come up with, seems like he's criticizing general welfare economics for having a very specific view of what the ideal society should look like, right? It's Pareto optimal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
He's raising all these things that would make it sound like, no, you can't do that. If you're going to do welfare economics, you can't take that approach. You can't think that you have a priori, an ideal to shoot at just because you understand the fundamentals of interdependence of markets and things. But at the same time, he thinks you don't need that in order to address specific problems.
So he's famous, right, for this capability approach?
Mm-hmm.
Tell something about that. It's fine to get more background on these guys because I don't have that much on him.
It's this idea that you take into account something other than people's self-interest, not just their subjective well-being or what they want, their preferences, let's say, but the things that we take to be objectively part of the good life. There's a very Aristotelian bent to this, actually. It sounds a lot like a sort of application of virtue ethics to economics, just from what I read up on. So you don't just let things happen according to the sum aggregate of what people want and how they behave based upon that. But you take into account what's good for people. And there's this talk of, well, Seth may have a better.
Yeah. So I can't actually speak to the details of the capabilities approach. The book he wrote on the subject is The Idea of Justice. So I would recommend people to that, but I have not read it. I guess what I'm going to say is that he's a consequentialist, right? That's the one thing he's kind of committed to. Mm-hmm. And the second that you want to say that something like inequality is something you care about, or the health of the people is something you care about, or giving people more freedom is something you care about, well, then practical concerns come into play and economics has a role in that. There's a million different ways to lower inequality. Should we just have a progressive tax system? Should we raise the minimum wage? Should we fix the price of bread? There's now a ceiling on the price of bread so everyone can afford it. Should we raise unemployment benefits? Should we have this kind of healthcare system versus that kind of healthcare system versus a third kind of healthcare system? These are all things that an approach to society that's actually trying to think about interactions in a quantitative way, you need to some quantitativeness. Mm-hmm. And so Sen thinks that economics is inevitable, even if he's got a lot of problems with the way it's practiced in 1986.
And all these have been solved now.
Yes, no. Actually, I've got my professor, he's got a list of policies. Look him up on thepurpleplan.com. Just do all of that stuff and society will be perfect.
Yeah.
Who's your professor?
Kotlikoff here at BU. Good guy.
Will, unfortunately, economics will only be partially corrected and fulfilled as long as Seth Benzel is still a PhD student.
Yeah, give me some time. I don't want him to fix everything before I get there.
Yeah, no. He's got to, that's what his dissertation is going to be, solving all the problems.
Is there a real conflict between what we read with the Hayek and then the criticisms of Sen? So Hayek said things like in The Road to Serfdom, you can prohibit poisonous substances, you certainly could have regulations. And he says things like, so to limit working hours or to require certain sanitary arrangements is fully compatible with the preservation of competition. And he goes on to say things about other sorts of regulations to protect the environment or to protect the poor or to prevent fraud. Is the kind of approach that Sen seems to be suggesting? I know we can't say a lot about this since we didn't really read about the capability approach, but is he advocating interference in the market or is he simply advocating something that's actually compatible with the idea of letting the market do its work and then using these add-ons that both Smith and Hayek seem to advocate to sort of mop up some of the problems with the market?
So you'd be hard-pressed to find an economist who doesn't think that there are market failures that call for interventions.
Right.
I don't know enough precisely about what's going on in Hayek's background to say whether he is a welfarist, which is to say he thinks the only good thing is people have more utility. Certainly, Sen thinks that people have more goods than only their utility. And once you believe that, well, then at least the naive Pareto efficiency, like at least the basic version, doesn't work anymore. Let me back up. The reason you want the Pareto efficiency as a criteria is because you guys talked all the way back in your utilitarianism episode about how interpersonal comparisons of utility, it's just super hard. It almost seems like a failed project from the start, right?
Say why that is, just to remind listeners.
Just think of any hard example of utilitarianism. Is it better to save one person's life or to let 10,000 people be inconvenienced?
If we lowered all the speed limits to 25 on the highways, we would definitely save some lives.
Yes.
And how do we weigh that against how much that slows down everything?
Exactly.
Millions of people will be late.
We got Homer Simpson here. So that's exactly Sen's point. So maybe you're not a welfarist. Maybe you think there's lots of different considerations that come into play there, but you have to be a consequentialist to answer that question. So there's ways economists do that. So there are people who do cost-benefit analysis where we choose a value for a human life. You say, I think it used to be, recently I looked, it was like $20 million or so. And you see, are everybody else going to be inconvenienced to the tune of $20 million? And if not, you know what? Let them keep on speeding. That's kind of a naive approach, but it's at least one way to make that decision. And it's hard to think how you would otherwise make the decision about optimal speed limits.
You were in the middle of saying something, though, about
Pareto efficiency. Interpersonal comparisons of utility are hard, given that you just get Pareto efficiency. We're welfarists. We want everyone's utility to be as high as possible. And we're consequentialists, right? So we should judge an action based on that. But we can't just add up everyone's utility because you just can't add up people's utility. I will now pause and say there are economists who just add up people's utility. There's a popular model to talk about optimal taxation systems. So you might think, okay, there's too much inequality. The way that we're going to fix that is we're going to tax poor people less than rich people. So you can plug in different parameters and get different answers. So you might say, I want the Rawlsian tax system. And so the Rawlsian tax system, it's the system of transfers that make the poorest person as well off as possible. And then maybe you care about the richer people after that. It's not going to be 100% tax on the rich because then they wouldn't work at all. So maybe it's just merely extremely high. Maybe it's a 70-80% tax on the rich. Or you might, on other extreme, take just a pure utilitarian approach and just say, I want the tax system that maximizes everyone's utility in total, then there would be much less redistribution. Now, how do you get from income to utility? You also have to make some assumptions in there. But that's an example of how you might use what they call a social welfare function that isn't just only thinking about Pareto efficiency. You could add something else on top of it. But Zen will say that it's still inadequate, because just a one-dimensional measure of how good someone's doing, it's just completely inadequate. And so the one thing he's sure about is that what people choose, they either choose their choosiest thing, they either choose the thing that maximizes their agency, they're choosing the thing that they choose, or they're choosing the thing that's best for them. And so I choose what's good for me. And what Sen points out is, and what you guys have been talking about, is those might have a lot to do with each other. Maybe a lot of the time I choose something that's good for me, but they almost certainly don't align perfectly. We talk, maybe there are some systems and values in which everyone only creates their values through choice. I don't know if you want to like bring existentialism into this.
That'd be awfully convenient for economists, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah. If you talk to my friends who are more hardcore libertarians and they're very hands-off, they'll make that argument. They'll say, there's no objective value. Just let people get more of what they want. That's the only good thing. Getting people what they want. People should get more of what they want.
Hmm. Well, and when the alternative sounds like, you don't know what you want, and we know better, then it just sounds implausible and arrogant, but it's not taking into account, I think, facts about our human nature.
Yeah, I think it's definitely true. So, for instance, in the Sandel episode, one of his criticisms of liberalism is that these more robust conceptions of the good beyond having our rights and our basic needs met and things like that, sort of reminiscent of, again, Aristotelian virtue ethics. But the question was, do we want a state-level endorsement or enforcement of those more robust senses of the good? It's not that they're not really important.
Are we confident that society can implement them in a satisfactory way?
Yeah, without becoming authoritarian. I mean, and that's Hayek's point, and I think it's a real question. I think it's naive to say the good is simply what people want, and there's something outside of that, and they can be very, very wrong about what they want. But then the question is, the extent to which we try and nanny state them or enforce some good for them, and the obvious ways in which that can go wrong and lead to authoritarianism and all sorts of other horrors. And I don't know how that translates exactly to economics. It's more a complicated question with economics. I'm still not even clear on whether Sen is calling for anything that even counts as a market fiddling in Hayek's terms. I'm still wondering if Sen's approach isn't actually consistent with Hayek's at some level.
Just from reading these two essays, I would guess that Sen would be more optimistic about paternalistic approaches. If Hayek sees an individual doing something that seems non-self-interested, Hayek would probably be more aggressive in trying to interpret that as self-interest. And Sen would be a little bit more cautious and say, well, maybe it's not self-interested behavior. Maybe it's something else. That's one of the big ambiguities that decision theorists and behavioral economists deal with, which is that there are a million different kinds of behaviors that are maybe rational, maybe irrational. I'll give you an example in intrinsic versus extrinsic motivations. Rationality seems to entail, or at least a lot of versions of the axioms that we assume about human behavior would entail something like, if I give you two good things, that's better than one good thing, right? So monotonicity.
Do you guys have a silly word for everything?
Yes, we have a silly word for everything, yes.
Okay. Well, if I give you two good things, it's better than one good thing.
Assuming the two good things have the same goodness.
Yeah, assuming they don't like interact in like a negative way, but we can come back to that.
I mean, one good thing with a goodness value of two is worth two good things with goodness values of one.
So let me give you an example. So you meet a woman on a date and you say to her, hey, would you like to head upstairs? Would you like to sleep with me? And so maybe she'll say yes, maybe she'll say no. So suppose she says yes, great.
I found that, by the way, to be very Pareto inefficient for getting laid. But go ahead.
That you're adding pleasure to your life detracts from the pleasure of the female. And so.
Well, she agreed to it in a mutually beneficial exchange, right?
Yeah. I was just thinking that that sounded very much, Seth, like the way an economist would make a pass. Excuse me. Would you like to come upstairs and have a mutually beneficial sexual encounter with me?
Yeah.
I promise nobody's utility will be lowered.
That's how you know it's a good choice. Now, suppose you go to that woman and you ask her now, hey, would you like to have sex with me? I'll give you $10. I would really not be surprised if she said no. So on the surface, that seems to violate a kind of rationality, right? Because she already showed that she likes having sex with you, right? But now she's saying, but I don't want $10 and having sex with you. That's kind of weird. And so, and so you can either say
– you could phrase it, do you want $10 plus having sex with me?
To offer the money first.
Yeah, there you go. So you, on the surface, you might say that's irrational behavior because she likes money and she likes sex. So why doesn't she like the combination? But then you might like not be stupid for a second. And then you'd say, no, there's something a little bit more subtle happening here. I'm giving her information about my lack of social understanding and now she won't want to sleep with me, right? So that would be a rational reason to deny the example. And it doesn't – examples like that, maybe there's some ambiguity between the rationality and the irrationality. Maybe that's not a good one.
Well, no, like you said, you can always – give a reinterpretation of why this is actually rational. This allegedly irrational behavior is rational according to some standard.
And so some stuff, decision theorists have to tie themselves up into knots to understand in an axiomatized way. And some stuff is straightforward. And some stuff, you know, you might just throw up your hands and say, the easiest and simplest interpretation is that somebody's making a mistake here, or they're making decisions in a way that economics is not going to have a good time describing.
And why does it matter that economics can accurately describe all these individual things when it seemed like, yeah, I mean, you could just say that when you aggregate, then these things all wash out.
So the answer is because economists have gone really wrong by just assuming, just by only looking at the macro level, right? So Keynesianism was dominant the 50s and 60s, but again, this is parable. I don't know if this is exactly how it worked. People noticed that the relationship between interest rates and unemployment that had seemed to underlie and explain and, you know, be the driving factor behind Keynesianism, it kind of stopped working. And then people said, well, no, you can't just make these upper level assumptions about what's going on. You have to look in the decisions of individuals. And if you go to the decision of the individual, well, the individual is now able to say, hey, now I anticipate a higher inflation rate. I anticipate a certain kind of interest rates. Now in my individual optimization, I'm going to make a different decision. So economists don't like to make these ad hoc, potentially really far off assumptions about the way society as a whole works. You're better off starting at the individual level, starting with the individual agents. And sure, they're oversimplified. And maybe there's a good part in that this oversimplification comes out in the wash at the macro level, but you're still better off starting with the individual. And then we can talk about situations where we think rationality does a really good job of describing behavior, certain, you know, zero-sum games, or there's some evolutionary settings where game theory seems to really apply.
I wondered if we were going to talk about game theory.
So, like, let me give you an example. The reason economists want to make these assumptions about human behavior is they want to make predictions. So suppose you just sat two people together to play a game of tic-tac-toe. If you can't make any assumptions about both players wanting to win and both players understanding the game and both players having an understanding of the game and trying to win the game, then it's going to be really hard to say where they're going to put X's and O's. But the second you say, okay, I'm going to say these are guys are both rational agents that are trying to win the game of tic-tac-toe and understand the rules and understand that the other person understands the rules, then you can start to make predictions about how they're going to play the game of tic-tac-toe. And so you might imagine that there are certain real life situations with very clear fixed rules that are analogous to that situation.
So what's an example of an economic principle or conclusion that you can get through this sort of analysis from bottom up, from individual behavior?
So the classic example of a game like this that explains behavior is the duopoly problem. So suppose there are two firms They're in the market, but there's only the two firms. So both of them have a little bit of monopoly power. There's Coke and Pepsi. They're the only people who make soda. They have to decide how much soda to make and what price to sell it at. The way that you maximize the total profits of both soda companies is for both of them to produce the amount that is half of the monopoly amount, right? Because the monopoly amount is the way that you extract the most profits possible from the system.
Say something about how you determine the monopoly amount. I mean, it seems like you just have to try it. That is, can we make it the most expensive thing and only the rich can? Oh, but if I lower it this much, then this many more people will pick it up. Or at some point, it's going to reach an equilibrium, which I don't know how you could predict.
So that's a good question. And so now I'm going to appeal to, you could look at historical series, is the amount of soda which is demanded and the price at which it's demanded. And you could kind of extrapolate from previous equilibrias of prices and quantities what the demand function kind of looks like. Suppose you have a kind of an idea of what the aggregate demand for soda looks like. The optimal for both of them is if they could coordinate and say, hey, look, I'm only going to make half the monopoly amount. You make the half the monopoly amount. We'll split the profits. But because unless they can cartelize, if they're really in competition with each other, that's not going to be the optimal amount for them. They're going to want to cheat a little bit on the other guy because they can make a little extra profits by producing a little bit more soda and lowering the price a little bit, right, and steal all the profits of the other guy. And it turns out that the equilibrium is somewhere in between the pure monopoly equilibrium in terms of the quantity and the price. So the quantity and price, quantity is going to be a little bit higher. The price is going to be a little bit lower than the monopoly. Mm-hmm. Quantity is going to be a little bit lower and the price is going to be a little bit higher than the perfect competition. So that would be an example of how we think game theoretical situations are going to inform real economic behavior. And if you look at the world, you see this result. You see that the more concentrated the monopoly, the higher the profits, and vice versa.
So the game theory is being played with regard to the producers and where they're going to set, not on the consumers.
Yeah. So in this example, the two producers are playing a game with each other. Each of them is trying to maximize their profits.
Why don't we bring this back a little bit to the why are we talking about game theory, at least in the context of this Sen article? It's part of his argument against the characterization of human beings as always maximizing self-interest, correct?
So do you want me to introduce the prisoner's dilemma?
Is that why we started off on that direction? Because we're now talking about Coke and Pepsi and monopolies.
We started off because I was trying to figure out if Sen is actually inconsistent, how inconsistent he is with Hayek, and then...
How successful is the assumption of rationality?
Yeah.
Wes, you're asking that question of Sen because based on that other background work you did on Hayek?
Yeah, based on the fact that, well, I didn't like Smith. I thought, well, you know, in the same way that Adam Smith is not inconsistent with these social programs, you know, is Hayek, and then and it, like he said the same sorts of things as Smith. But also, so what I'm wondering is, the Sen's concern with these other sorts of goals, don't they both agree? Yes, the markets do some things very well, other things they don't do well. Mm-hmm. And so you mix a market economy with certain regulations and safety nets. And then the question always becomes, well, how much do I regulate and interfere? But there's no question about interference. That's going to occur. This isn't really a debate between someone who's laissez-faire and someone who's advocating intervention. So I'm wondering if there's a real conflict here. Or is Sen saying, no, it's not enough to simply tack on certain policies or social programs. There's a fundamentally different way, and part of this is just we haven't read enough of him to know, but is there a fundamentally different way to do economics? And again, and here we get into the whole problem of there's really two questions. One is about predicting people's behavior, regardless of your own goals for the economy. You know, so Sen seems to be saying, well, if I were able to take into account people's goals that don't have to do with self-interest, their normative goals or their group loyalty, these other things, I could better predict behavior and I'd be a better descriptive economist. But then there's the other part of it where I, the economist, have these normative goals for the well-being of people within a society. And so how, what economic policies do I use to achieve that? So those are the two different things. And anyway, I'm wondering, because we only got a little taste of this, what the real practical upshot for an economist, I think Mark was kind of pointing this, it seems implausible that you could say, I'm going to have a function that takes into account people's different group loyalties and things like that for doing things. And I'm going to be a better predictor of economic behavior based on that. That seems to me to be implausible on its face.
But you can get more, again, you don't need a perfect model in order to achieve enough insight to then have the levers at your disposal to move some things. So he points out Smith thought that famine was just a matter of ultimately availability, right? You have famine if there's not enough food, and thought that we just need to remove barriers. So he was against tariffs or something was brought up in this. But Sen comes out very clearly. I think he says that in opposition to Smith, it's been recognized. It's a common economic knowledge that it has to do with a lot of different interdependencies and not to do with just scarcity.
It might just be people are too poor to buy food.
Right. And so how do we look at the cycle of the stuff that we worry about, between of employment and skills and the situations, what character, you know, so you get a whole lot of complicated issues in terms of how do you unravel those dependencies. Like Wes, it wasn't clear to me. I was reading into Sen that he was more open to any kind of intervention that would work, even if it completely makes something not even a market commodity anymore, which seemed to be off the table as far as what I was seeing in Hayek. All right, before we continue on that, let's talk about our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the cost. Now, you might think that going to a mattress shop, trying out the mattresses, lying on them, that's part of the process. But really, statistically, lying in a bed in a showroom has no correlation to whether it's the right bed for you. So that big, nice showroom with all the mattresses, all the people showing you things, that's just part of what you're paying for. It's an enormous waste. Now, Casper is able to offer mattresses much more cheaply because they don't do that. You order it online. Now, Casper understands the importance of really trying out a mattress, which is why they offer a 100-day period in which you can painlessly return it. Plus, you get free delivery in the first place. Casper's mattresses are way below the cost of what you're going to see in a showroom. You can get $500 for a twin or $950 for a king-size mattress. Compared to industry averages, that's an outstanding price point. And you can save an additional $50 as one of our audience members by going to casper.com/PEL and entering the promo code PEL. Now, I have one of these mattresses. I've been using it for months now. I have absolutely no complaints. It's very comfortable. It combines latex and memory foam, long-lasting comfort and support. So go ahead, try sleeping on a Casper mattress. You can buy it easily online, completely risk-free. Casper's mattresses are made in the USA. Remember, that's casper.com/PEL. Enter the promo code PEL. All right, now Seth, tell them about our other sponsor, Squarespace.
You know, guys, building a website can be tough, and maintaining it, as we've seen recently, even tougher. Even if you know your way around coding, creating something that looks good and works well is a time-consuming affair. Whether it's for a business site, a portfolio, a restaurant, a philosophy blog, or whatever else, in this day and age, you probably need a website anyway. Well, lucky for us, Squarespace makes it easy to build beautiful websites without breaking a sweat. Wouldn't you like to be able to build a beautiful website easily without breaking a sweat?
As a rational, self-interested actor, yes, I certainly would.
I prefer not to be sweating while I'm doing anything with electronics.
That's an excellent point. Well, Squarespace has functioned beautifully in the free market to provide simple, powerful, and beautiful websites that look professionally designed, regardless of your skill level, with no coding required. Not only does Squarespace provide you with intuitive and easy-to-use tools to create your website with, Squarespace also has state-of-the-art technology powering your site to ensure security and stability. And I'm sure...
Security? I love security.
Ensure security and stability. In the news recently, we've seen the importance of having security and stability for your website, particularly if you're in the business of using the free market for your sexual needs. Now, you know you can trust in Squarespace for your website when you need millions of people and some of the most respected brands in the world trust them too. We won't speculate, but I'm assuming that Ashley Madison was not built on Squarespace. Seriously, you can't beat the ease and simplicity of Squarespace. It gives you 24/7 online support and a beautiful website for only $8 a month. You can even get a free domain if you buy Squarespace for the year. Start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. So when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code PEL. Get 10% off your first purchase and to show your support for the Partially Examined Life. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
All right, thanks. Let's get back to it.
One of the big things Sen is doing. So if you read Hayek, the most important paragraph is the first paragraph where he says two things. One, he says, all right, the economic problem is easy. A, once we have our ranking of social preferences. And B, once you know the ranking of social preferences, all that remains is to set marginal rates of substitution equal, right? So Sen spends this entire essay, especially the third lecture, talking about why making a social ranking is really, really hard. Even though you might want to be a consequentialist, there are still issues of, you know, he brings up Agamemnon's daughter, right? Is it better to burn your daughter or to win the war, right? That's just a hard question, and you're not going to solve that question.
Although the way you put it, it's actually clear.
No Game of Thrones spoilers?
It is better to win the war than burn your daughter.
Well, yeah, well, so Sen says it's not clear.
Yeah.
And the answer can't just be, we'll yell at Agamemnon, have preferences over burning your daughter and winning the war. And then once you have preferences, just choose the one you prefer, right? That doesn't seem to be a solution to the problem. Whereas Hayek is taking a system of preferences as given. And in order to get that marginal rates of substitution be equal results, you're going to really need to assume something like welfarism, right? Something like everyone has a unidimensional good and you maximize the total good or you get an efficient result by setting the substitutions of goods or according to such and such a rule, right? So
I thought we stipulated that when we created the model, that it's simplistic and it doesn't account for everything and that we're going to have to jerry-rig it after it's all over.
Yeah. So then to answer your question, the answer is I don't know enough about Hayek to know how much he thinks that there are other things than utility. But I mean, Seth, you read Road to Serfdom. Maybe you can speak to this.
I'm not sure that that's the right question here. And what I mean by that is I don't know that Hayek is going to have as much of an issue with the arguing about the notion of rationality. Hayek's point is going to keep coming back to this notion of central planning and policymaking. And so the real question is, what's the jumping off point? So Sen has, you know, we haven't really talked in detail about it, but he has a whole slew of arguments about why the narrow version of rationality doesn't work. It's not reflective of how people actually make choices, about why you want to take a broader view that he takes from Adam Smith, which he says, by the way, is the secret underpinning of economics is Stoicism. Because he talks about how Adam Smith was influenced by the Stoics.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this prudence thing with Smith.
Yep. Yeah. Prudence is the union of reason and understanding and self-command. And the self-command comes into play when you have to sublimate or compromise your own interests and desires for that of the greater whole, which is a central part of Adam Smith's moral theory that doesn't show up in later economics, according to Sen. Then he talks about utilitarianism, which you mentioned the three aspects of utilitarianism, which are consequentialism, welfarism, and sum ranking. He likes consequentialism. He doesn't like the other things. Then he talks about duality of the person in ethical calculation, that we just focus on well-being and we don't focus on agency. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the part where I think we start to see where there might be a difference. Sen says, you know, we're talking about maximizing well-being. What's the connection between Pareto efficiency or the fundamental welfare theorem and utilitarianism? Well, Pareto efficiency, which is a state at which nobody's utility can be increased without decreasing and somebody else's, is, in philosophical parlance of utilitarianism, the greatest good for the greatest number. And he's trying to make the point that Pareto efficiency is the logical extension in economics of that utilitarian maxim. So he says, here's a bunch of reasons why utilitarianism conceived that way is not right. And it's all the standard ones. You know, one is how do you measure it? One is how can you have incommensurate values for goods? How do you compare those types of goods, et cetera? It's the Socrates dissatisfied or the pig satisfied problem. He goes further just to say, on top of that, if you look at a person as an agent, as a human being and as a rational agent, or sorry, as an acting agent in their own life and in the community, to see them simply in terms of their well-being and their utility is extremely limited. You need this other aspect, which is what he calls agency, which is really focusing on not just their focus towards their own well-being, but geared towards their sense of freedom, their sense of what possibilities are available to them, and extending out to the types of choices that they are capable of making, the types of things from which they can choose. And I think this is where I start to see something where Sen can distinguish himself from Hayek because, well, that's not even that important. We just happen to read these two things together. They aren't necessarily they could be complementary or contradictory, but is that I think what Sen is pointing at with that is something like the distinction between meaning and happiness. And it's very odd that just this week I came across Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning and read an article about Frankl. And, you know, he talks about how happiness is an outcome and that meaning is something that we need, that human beings actually need. And I got, maybe it's just because I was reading these things at the same time, but I feel like when Sen talks about meaning and agency, he's trying to recast what freedom would really mean for somebody, and not in the economic sense that Hayek talks about, which is the ability to pursue whatever using your own skills and knowledge, but something more existential, as you mentioned earlier, where you have a freedom to generate meaning for your life. And that he's making a call that economics somehow needs to incorporate that in the way that they view human agency. I think this is where it starts to jump off, and it gets to that end point of, he starts saying that if you start thinking in those terms and you start taking that into account, then you get pushed towards talking about the way people value their existence and not just the choices they make, and that the valuing system is much more complicated than we make it out to be. Then you get into the decision problem for both individuals and from a policy perspective, where an institution might have to make a decision where you have these conflicting values that aren't monist. That's how I read that whole essay coming together in that way, is that he's ultimately defeating the fundamental welfare theorem by saying the reality is human beings value things in different ways from each other and also different ways at different times. And this complexity in the valuing system is what we really need to focus on. And the way we do that is by throwing out all this other apparatus and enriching our view of what human behavior is, et cetera.
I don't know if he wants to throw out all the other apparatus, but he certainly wants to enlarge the apparatus.
Well, he has all kinds of caveats at the beginning about how he's not saying that traditional economics and the engineering approach isn't useful for a lot of things. So,
not only is it useful, but it can inform our ethics. Did you guys find that a particularly convincing point that he just throws that out?
That was just a sop to his critics, I think.
Maybe I can bring in Arrow's impossibility theorem. Maybe that's something he's thinking about here, right? So one of the things that I was thinking about when I listened to the Sandel episode is he said, okay, well, the answer to all these problems of how should we weigh these different values is we should all get together and talk about it. And then after we talk about it, we'll all have a vote. And then we'll choose the value system that we all like.
That wasn't clear, but go ahead.
But there was a conversation that happens, and then we get a better social outcome. Okay.
Yes.
What Arrow's impossibility theorem says is that there is no voting system that's going to be able to resolve these questions in an obviously correct way. To give an example, suppose Wes prefers social outcome A to B to C. Seth prefers social outcome B to C to A. Mark prefers social outcome C to B to A. I don't know. I missed the middle one. You're following me. So what happens here is if we have a head-to-head vote on these different issues, A is going to beat B, B is going to beat C, but then C is going to beat A. So we have intransitive preferences when we set up all these options together.
And that's how Trump wins.
But what you get out of this is that not only is this just a problem with, you know, the voting system that I proposed, which is you put two things head to head and you choose the one that has the highest votes. There is no conceivable voting system, which is always chooses the Pareto dominant choice, and the answer doesn't depend on which options are presented, that you can present the options in a different way and get a different answer. And there's some other, those are the two interesting ones. And so economics, therefore, has something to say about, here's a way you can't solve this problem, which is we all vote on what our values are.
Mm. So how is that related to?
So you asked, is there anything economics can say normatively? And so maybe that's something economics can inform ethics in a way there.
Oh, I see.
Yes. Ethics being in the enlarged sense of that Aristotle took it, it's not just determining, you know, what the good is, but in a practical sense, how to actually achieve it.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're king, you still need to choose an option, and it seems like you should choose the most ethical choice or whatever. And so here would be one way that you might choose the ethical choice is you have everybody have a vote, and that doesn't work. Or it's got problems, at least. That's a little bit too far.
So I think the problem that we were having, at least what I was having with these readings, is that we're walking into the middle of a bunch of disputes, and it's sort of unclear what the players are or what's at stake in these disputes. So, I mean, Hayek starts out his essay, "What is the problem we wish to solve when we try to construct a rational economic order?" And I wasn't even clear, like, well, what does that really mean? Is he trying to do that? Is he...
Well, he says it in the next sentence. I want to get the best, you know, once I have a ranking of social outcomes, I just try to get the best social outcome possible.
Who is he arguing against? The central planner, you know, that seems to think that just like I'm going
all
to
the commies.
Plan the...
That's who's arguing, man.
Yeah, plan my house, plan the expenses of my house. I want to plan the expenses of the entire nation, of everybody in the nation. I mean, is that really, that was a live option at the time?
What do you call communism, right? That's central planning insofar as possible. Who gets what? Who works where? What's produced? Five-year plan, increase iron production 3,000 times, blah, blah, blah.
Yes, it was a live problem at the time. It is no longer a live problem, except in the case of China.
Well, not in China, really.
Well, you know, they have a mixed system. But I will say very amusingly, so Chile under Allende actually tried to like implement, you got to look at this picture, man, I think it's like cyber stents or something like that. They tried to make like a command center for Chile where everyone had like these high tech chairs and they would get constant streams of information from all of the factories and all of the farms in Chile. And they'd be able to make real time adjustments and tell, oh, this truck go there and that truck go this other place. And, you know, centrally command their economy, and it was a debacle in ways that are unsurprising to an economist.
Or to anyone with a practical bent.
Oh, man. I like that idea, though.
You just like the Star Trek kind of...
I like the idea of sitting in a chair and having information flow to me. That's right.
Yeah, if so many of these issues we've discussed here are epistemological issues, then... Yeah, the question is very natural. Like, well, haven't we made advances in, you know, if it's a communication problem and that's why the centralized planner is having trouble? Or Hayek talks about people actually look down. They think it's almost contemptible to have specific knowledge. Anyone who by such knowledge gains an advantage over somebody better equipped with theoretical or technical knowledge is thought to have acted almost disreputably. So just for instance, knowing that the price for something is slightly different over the border. So your whole business just becomes buying that thing from the one place and driving it to the other place.
And driving down the price difference, yep.
Yes. So we think that's slimy somehow, he thinks. But yet that's actually, it's doing what is socially good. It's evening out the need.
It's an essential function. So let me give an example of why you might think that's sleazy. So like the sleazy version of this is you have a stockpile of oil that you've saved up. And then there's an interruption in the world supply of oil, and you say to your community, ha, 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 I have all the oil. Now I'm going to charge you a very high price. So he had the private information of knowing that there was going to be an oil interruption. Now, again, introduce the problem of monopoly, but if there's enough people who know about the oil interruption, then there's a lot of people
right.
who store it up. Yeah.
Yeah. So it seems all those dynamics have changed. Like just even knowing that something is a slightly lower price over the border, like, well – now with the internet, can't you just check that?
So, but think about the kind of extraordinarily detailed information that you need, right? That's the kind of the easy problem. The hard problem is if I really wanted to, you know, just distribute goods, how many tomatoes should Seth get and how many bottles of gin should Mark get and how many tables should Wes get?
Oh, thank God I got the tables.
Those are the kinds of things you need to know.
Yeah.
And those are the kind of things that even now companies are not very good
at knowing. Yeah, so I mean, so that's kind of the big long-term question. You know, with the rise of big data and Facebook watching you all the time, maybe Facebook knows how much more you need a chair than a table. Probably not. Maybe they'll get there in some distant century, but we're certainly not there yet.
I mean, even if we had the central planner who had perfect information, let's suppose. An economic god.
Sure.
What would be the drawback of that? I mean...
So then there's two problems. So suppose you get economic god. So you still have three problems. Problem number one, why is he going to act in the interest of the community rather than be an angry god? Okay. Problem number two, you still need people to act according to your instructions. So you might say, okay, Seth, I've decided that the socially optimal thing is for you to go work in the salt mines, right? It might very well be the case that that is the socially optimal thing, but the central planner still got to figure out a way to incentivize you to do that. And then I think those are the two big problems. Yeah, I had a third problem in mind.
You don't need a third problem after that second one. Because
thanks, Rick Perry.
Fuck social optimality if my job is salt mining. Yeah. Well, so there's that live problem that we started off discussing, and it obviously was less live for, what is it, 1986? So what, the wall came down in 89, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I got my years
something,
right.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, the bigger issue, and part of the reason why I'm interested in this subject is I try to understand economic principles as they apply to what's happening in our society. Because I feel like things have become so complex and society is so economically driven that part of what you need to be an informed citizen is you have to understand some of what goes on. And then you find out, no fucking way can you do that. Like, there's no way an ordinary human being, even with tens or twenties of hours of study, can get a good sense of the mortgage crisis, the banking bailout, the Greece debt crisis. And there's just stuff that's happening underneath all of this. There's layers and layers of slime, the banking and the international financial systems and all this stuff. The way these things move to impact our lives is really severe. So, you know, I'm interested in this because I'm trying to understand. But the one thing that when I listen to podcasts on economics or when I read articles or books on it, I'm trying to understand is that you hear these people get into this debate, oh, it's regulation versus the free market and the regulations didn't work, or no, it was the wrong regulations, or maybe we shouldn't have had regulations, we should have had more transparency. Well, you know, the lenders were incented by the government. It's Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's fault because we wanted everybody to be a homeowner. So everybody starts talking about human behaviors, whether it's the way humans behave when they consume, the way humans behave when they run financial institutions, the clowns at the Federal Reserve, you know, whatever. And so
the clowns.
You're calling Janet Yellen a clown?
No, I'm thinking of her predecessor.
Bernanke?
Yes. And what seems to come down over and over again is a really, really immature conception of what it means of how human beings act. And also a real lack of normativity to just say, oh, well, the reason why Goldman Sachs and the bankers of Goldman Sachs did all these things was because the financial incentives were there for them to do it, is like saying, well, you know what? There was a gun on the table and a piece of paper. There was a handwritten note that said, hey, it's okay to kill people. So yeah, that's why he killed him. It does not answer the question, and it does not hold these people accountable for acting like fucking human beings that live in a community and a society. And this is the thing that I keep hearing over and over again, and it's really frustrating me. And so part of the reason why I've been pushing for this is I'm like, there has got to be some really basic flaw that I don't understand in the way that economics sees human behavior. And I need a better way of articulating what that is, and I need a good solid philosophical foundation to do it. I have my ideas, but that's part of what was motivating this for me.
Did this help?
Yeah.
Are you going to have to invite me on for a new episode where we look at some actually applied papers instead of just this abstract theory?
You know what? I think I definitely thought the Sen paper helped to articulate some of the, what I would say, philosophical deficiencies in the notion of rational behavior and the idea that, you know, this utilitarianism is internalized as a kind of quasi-ethical, in a weird way, an ethical system there. So it's helped me with some of that. Now I need to go back and kind of revisit something like some of these specific issues that we've seen. Like, maybe we go back and we look at the mortgage crisis and we look at how it came about and what the response was. And then we start asking ourselves this question: if Obama wasn't the president, if the president of the United States didn't have such close ties to the banking industry and the financial industry, if there wasn't this free flow of people and knowledge and influence between the public sector and the private sector around these sorts of things. If being a government official wasn't simply preparation for a lucrative career as a lobbyist or a consultant, would decisions have been different? And this idea that somebody convinced themselves that we couldn't just allow these companies that basically should have gone out of business for bad business practices because it was going to cause this massive ripple. We have to protect the American people or the world economy by propping up these banks. Like, I don't know. Maybe I need now I go back and look at that and see if it makes any more sense. And I don't know that it will, even though I feel like I have a better understanding of some of the underpinnings of economics. Maybe there's something else going on that I just don't understand.
The short answer is that, so that's a positive question. So believe it or not, that's actually kind of a big open question. There's a lot of debate. I'm kind of working a little bit in the area of optimal banking regulation policy, and there really are some unanswered questions, but the way that you're going to solve these questions isn't by giving up on economics. In fact, I think economics is the only field in which you can answer these questions of, would it be optimal to let the banks fail or would it not be?
Listen, I'm interested in it, and I think I'm interested in it for good reason. And there is definitely a way to answer Mark's question to some extent. There are principles of what we'll call logistical economics, which do shed light on human behavior and can help us inform. So I'll give you a good example. There's a really good episode of Econ Talk, which is a podcast on economics by this guy, Russ Roberts, who's part of Stanford's Hoover Institute. And he's got a regular guest on named Mike Munger, who's also an economist. And they have done a couple of episodes about price gouging during natural disasters. Mm-hmm. So after Hurricane hit North Carolina, you know, there were people that had water and they went and sold that water to the people in the affected areas. And they have a very sensitive, meaningful, interesting and illuminating conversation about how that all works and what the issues are on both sides of it. Mm-hmm. You know, is it fair for the government to restrict what the people who have the resources, the water, can charge when those people took a risk because they went into a devastated area? You know, it goes on. There's a very...
Although I will point out, like, the whole welfareism thing is like, we don't care what's fair, which is what's the optimal thing to allow it or to not allow it. But keep going.
Right. No, I'm just saying that's an example of a discussion between economists about an economic issue, but talks specifically about the human impact and illuminates that situation in a way that a couple of philosophers would do it differently. In other words, it's something you can actually learn something from it. Now, what I have learned from all of the things that I've studied in this and is that the market is getting violated constantly. And that it's almost meaningless to say that we have a free market because we don't. There are billions of dollars in subsidies to giant corporations. There's cronyism. There's asymmetrical information. I mean, you want to talk about banking reform? You know, fuck the regulations. How about transparency? You know, how about actually having a view about what these guys are and gals, I guess, are doing? But everything's hidden, right? You know, they don't want to put labels on food to tell you what's in it. They don't want to tell you what goes on, that you can't understand what banking instruments are when they package up mortgages and do things like this. All this stuff is hidden in secrecy, which should be the first red flag. First of all, it's the first thing that tells you the market's not free. Secondly, it should be a red flag that somebody is doing something they shouldn't be doing. When we're ready to have that conversation, you want to slash all the subsidies for agriculture and, you know, we want to change all the rules and have a truly free market, then when Rand Paul says that, then I'll believe he's really a libertarian. So show me a libertarian who's ready to truly have a free market, and I will show you a unicorn.
Hey, listen, I don't see it all or nothing, but I'm not a libertarian. I totally agree that the stance that hardcore libertarians take, that all government intervention is unethical, it can't be a consequentialist stance. It has to be a rights-based stance. You can only argue that from the Nozick angle, not from the utility angle.
Right.
Yep. And you can only argue it maybe from the lunatic angle, but that's another.
Well, after that very long closing, I feel like I shouldn't add very much for myself, but I have much. This has obviously been building up for a long time in you, Mr. Paskin, so I'm glad you got to have this initial explosion here. I didn't find the readings difficult. They were very easy to read, but I, again, did not feel like I understood who was being addressed. I kept trying to relate it to the things that I personally worry about. You know, even if you think that, of course, the price system has to be the norm, I still think all the necessities, or at least most of the necessities, out of the market system. And, you know, you don't need to have godlike powers to know that everybody needs protection from fires.
Okay.
So,
I mean, where do you end necessity, right? Where does need end and want begin?
Well, that's the ongoing conversation that Sandell referred to, that I didn't hear any indication that it would end with a vote. You know, maybe a provisional vote should we do this particular thing, but it's an ongoing philosophical, you know, it should be our main thing as a culture to sort of get ourselves more talking about and aware of what it is we actually want. You know, that's when people talk about we need to have a conversation on race. Well, that's partly, that is a real thing. It's a conversation of trying to figure out, well, what actually would equality be and what measures could we actually take to achieve that? And that should be an ongoing thing in terms of all areas of welfare. What counts as a need? What is the human good? And don't just sort of arbitrarily say, oh, well, it's just whatever people choose, or, you know, any kind of easy answer like that.
Yeah, but we don't have that kind of society. I mean, there's more than the market at work in this society. We have a sort of welfare state, and I think the same thing goes for most economies in the world today. It seems like Hayek is just saying, you know, you don't have state ownership of the means of production. But who would argue against that? This is my confusion about how inconsistent Zen is. Like, do any of us really think the state should own the means of production at this point, with all the disastrous examples of how that didn't work, where they simply own and run the companies? So the conversation is much more subtle than that. And to say there are all these flaws in the market, or there are lots of market failures, isn't an argument against the primacy of the market that Hayek is talking about, at least as far as I can see. But I wish I knew more about Sen to see how, if he's advocating anything that goes further than social programs and regulations and the sorts of things that I don't see as inconsistent with a market economy.
I don't see them as being particularly inconsistent either. And I think where these readings leave us is that these kinds of interventions call for a case-by-case analysis, and we can have a conversation about what we value and try to construct a outcome of social rankings. And then when we evaluate policies, we shouldn't enact them because maybe this is a straw man too, but we shouldn't enact policies because they feel like they should do the right thing. But rather, we're making informed decisions based on what we have observed empirically as interdependencies between different things, and are backed up by theories that it sounds like people will act in the way that is necessary for these outcomes to come to pass.
Well, I think we should legislate based on gut.
The Trump method.
Just gut. Just gut in. Just, you know, just go up there. The decider.
What has God told you about what the outcome of this economic decision will be? That's the only question, really. Speaking of, next time, we're going to be talking about Stoicism. Like we said, Epictetus, 135 CE, the handbook, also called Enchiridion. Since that is the underpinning of economics, then we'll... everything we discussed this time will be unraveled with that discussion, surely.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for putting up with our ignorance, Mr. Pincel. Did you have any other, I know we really enlightened you.
I got some good paper ideas. I brought a quote here that I find really inspirational and brought me to the study of economics. And it's a quote by Keynes on the study of economics.
Do your best Keynes voice.
I don't know what he's...
Our study of economics.
The study of economics does not seem to require any specialized gifts of an unusually high order. Is it not, intellectually regarded, a very easy subject compared with the higher branches of philosophy and pure science? Yet good or even competent economists are the rarest of birds, an easy subject at which very few excel. The paradox finds its explanation, perhaps, and that the master economist must possess a rare combination of gifts. He must reach a high standard in several different directions and must combine talents not often found together. He must be mathematician, historian, statesman, philosopher, in some degree. He must understand symbols and speak in words. He must contemplate the particular in terms of the general and touch the abstract and concrete in the same flight of thought. He must study the present in the light of the past for the purposes of the future. No part of man's nature or his limitations must lie entirely outside his regard. He must be purposeful and disinterested in a simultaneous mood, as aloof and incorruptible as an artist, yet sometimes as near the earth as a politician. And so that's why I like economics.
Wow. Good luck being that guy.
He must know when to hold them.
When I was reading Sen's essay, I was put to mind of the immortal words of Public Enemy. You got to give them what they want. You got to give them what they need. Our freedom of speech is freedom or death. You must fight the powers that be.
There you go.
Fight the powers that be.
Awesome. We are supported by your donations. Please go to partiallyexaminedlife.com to make a contribution. Big donors since last time have included Sam Hitt, Jesper Hansen, Mark Gwynn Landry, Charlene Mendoza, Luke Tilbury, Stephen Couch, James Roberts, Ian Foxworth, Harry Lovestrom, Faith Cossack, Gary Hellman, Robert Coldren, Cheryl Swain, Carrie Shaw, Ken Combs, Timothy Adamson, William Mascioli, Jordan Batchelor, Paul Honan, Sam McLean, Jacob Rosen, Stephen Gelber, Paul Kennedy, Peter Copeland, Wade Ains, Joel Carter, Gonzalo Roque, Michael Rosati, Kenneth Stewart, Tyler Schnobelin, Mario Calamango, Douglas Potter, Alexander West, John Graves, Bjorn Dalby, Nina Gershowitz, Jeffrey Williams, Dean Vanier, Rebecca Ott, Hugh Schultze, John Ellis, Paul Simmons, Thomas Knight, John Lago, Penny Park, Malcolm Hansen, David Kirkbarton, Jared Logsdon, Matthew Kelly, Clinton Diener, Chris Green, Megan Edwards, Rodrigo Capra, and Melanie Zenz. Thanks also to the many smaller donors, including those who are newly or on a continued basis signed up for our $5 a month citizen site. Now, we understand some of you are poor. It's fine. But another thing you could do to assuage your guilt is go on the iTunes store and leave us with a nice rating. If you want to interact with us more, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com, check out the blog. You could join our Facebook group. You could follow us on Twitter. And if you live in the Pittsburgh area, on Saturday, September 26th, we will be doing a live recording of episode 125 covering Hannah Arendt's The Human Condition. This is part of the second annual Pittsburgh Continental Philosophy Network Conference at Duquesne University. The theme of the conference is Uncommons, Theory and Public Space, devoted to critical examination of the public sphere, analysis of public space, as well as analysis in public space. It takes place that whole weekend, the 25th and the 26th. We're going to be there the whole time. We're going to be doing a Q&A on the 25th, in fact, and partying with anybody that's in town on the evening of the 25th. The Hannah Arendt portion of it is going to be from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. on the Saturday. That's Eastern time, and everybody should know that because we are planning to do a live simulcast of that. So keep an eye on PartiallyExaminedLife.com for details of how you can watch that as it's happening. And we'll, of course, take the edited audio and make the episode out of it.
It was a lot of fun, guys. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, good night, everybody.
Good night.
You as they please. People who throw away words are always disgruntled by something. You might say they're driven, you might say obsessed by something that they don't think not for the best. People who throw away time are the ones classically lazy. They are the most paranoid. Turning their will on the world. scheme of